I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kids suffer from traumatic experiences just like anybody else. Often the effects bleed into school and interfere with learning. But what if schools, teachers, and counselors could help? Today, find out about a new technique Kansas City Public Schools is trying out. It's called trauma-sensitive schooling, and it has the potential to improve attendance, behavior, and student success. Then, the story of two rogue nuns and why they had to fight so hard to start a nonprofit childcare center. Operation Breakthrough was tough to get off the ground, but it's been helping Kansas Cityans now for 46 years. After that, the latest weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. As the Kansas City, Missouri School District works to regain accreditation, it's changing its approach to dealing with students who have suffered trauma and, as a result, have misbehaved at school. For a lot of years, the approach was a zero-tolerance policy. You misbehave at school and you're booted out or the police are called. Instead of spending their days in school, students spend their time navigating the criminal justice system. It becomes a school-to-prison pipeline. By developing trauma-sensitive schools, though, the Kansas City School District is aiming for better attendance rates, fewer students losing valuable class time, and a higher percentage of students completing the school year. But will it work? Here to talk about it are Ajibola Adepaju, I was going to get it sooner or later, is a behavior therapist at the Success Academy at Knott's, which is an elementary school. Ajibola, nice to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Ellie Moxley is an education reporter. She'll be joining us in just a moment here at KCUR. And Julie Bean is the executive director for the Attachment and Trauma Network. Julie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Julie, the switch from a zero-tolerance policy to trauma-sensitive schools strikes me as a huge leap. How did this come about, and when did it come about?
Well, a lot of it is based in the ACEs study that was done as long ago as 25 years and has been replicated in 32 states at this point, the early Adverse Childhood Experiences study that really showed the impact that early adversity, things such as trauma, abuse, neglect, witnessing violence, living in poverty, and even such things as living with people with mental illness or divorces or separation from your primary caregiver, the research is out there that shows how that impacts a young child's development and how it impacts their ability to function in society and even their ability to learn. That work has come along for the last 25 years. Applying it to schools is a relatively new concept. Around the late 2005, 6, 7, there was research starting to emerge on that, but implementing it has really been in the last 5 to 10 years.
Ajibola, you work in this area. Why is this the right thing to do?
It's really important because in the academic environment, in order for a child to be successful, we understand that social and emotional needs must be met and addressed. And it's going to create an environment where students are ready to learn. And that's ultimately the goal.
That's where we want to be. Yeah. When we talk about trauma, then, affecting our kids, we're talking about what kinds of trauma, what kinds of experiences have these kids been forced to endure that you've come across?
Well, there's a complete range. You have children that are dealing with homelessness, lack of food, nutrition, a lot of domestic violence, poverty, sexual assault, trauma.
You name it, they've experienced
it.
Yeah, okay. Ellie, as a reporter covering issues like this, how much of a difference do you think it's made this move to trauma-sensitive schools. How big of a deal, how significant is this?
I mean, the whole reason I did this story, it was kind of a follow-up to a study that St. Louis Public Radio did last year looking at the high number of out-of-school suspensions for young Black male students in Missouri. KCPS was one of the districts that, you know, had a really high rate of suspensions in previous years. And, you know, when I went to the district, like, obviously this is a touchy subject, but one of the things that I found in my reporting last year was the district was already moving to changing their discipline policies, you know, to try to be more aware of the out-of-school factors, is what we call them, that affect their students' lives. So it was really nice to actually be able to follow up and do a story that I felt was showing, you know, it's incremental progress. That's always kind of how it works in education. You can't just change everything at once. But it was nice to go back and see, you know, kind of what that actually looks like in a school, what, you know, behavior therapists actually do, what it actually means to have someone in charge of mental health services now at the district.
Because no question, this is a big switch for education, a big change in mindset, right?
I think so. And I think it's something that one of the things that people told me again and again is that, you know, this is really ingrained in people. Most of us, when we hear about, you know, discipline, we think about punishment. We think about, you know, what's going to, you know, what it looks like when a kid gets in trouble. We want it to be kind of punitive. That's how most of us went to school.
Yeah.
And this is just a really different way of thinking about it. It's thinking about, you know, how do we have consequences when kids do act out in school? But how do we make sure that, you know, they're understanding why what they did was wrong? And how do we give them the support so that they can correct that behavior and not go back to it?
To what extent, just another quick thing here, Ellie, is the emphasis on trauma-sensitive schools a priority of the Kansas City District's still relatively new superintendent? That's Mark Bedell.
You know, I think this was an initiative that was already rolling before Bedell came on. But, you know, from my interactions with the superintendent and where he is, I think that this is something he's really trying to figure out. You know, we need to look at the whole kid. We can't just look at, you know, their academic performance because, you know, to get them ready to be at school, we have to consider all of these other things. We've got to make sure they're ready to learn when they walk through the doors.
That's interesting. Julie, I've read where you've said that you're actually surprised that there's been so little research done on the impact of trauma on kids and what that means for them, what it means for our schools. How little research has been done in this area?
Well, I think that it's all very emerging at this point. There really have not been a lot of school districts like Kansas City, what Kansas City is attempting to come in from the top down, and that really is the solution. From, you know, just the brain science tells us that, and just the support that teachers need in the classroom, it has to be an entire policy type change. And the schools that we've worked with that have done those types of things, suspension rates go down, graduation rates come up. So I think the research is going to bear that out exactly.
But we know for a fact, Julie, that the impact of trauma lingers for a very long time here, right?
Yes, it really does and can have lifelong impact. However, the research is also indicating that that resiliency is the antidote to trauma, and that resiliency can be built through making connections and helping children learn how to regulate, how to restore relationships, how to be connected in a healthy way. And that's something that teachers and school systems can be actively involved in teaching.
Julie, what do we know about what happens to the brain when someone experiences a significant trauma, even a kid?
Well, the kid part is the significant part. It's that the earlier the trauma is and the more chronic it is, the more impactful it is to your development.
Yeah.
The actual brain structure changes, and the child's inability to calm themselves, to regulate and put their cortex, their thinking brain online, is significantly impaired. So we have to go into them at an emotional experiential level and really help them learn to calm themselves and learn to, you know, to bring their thinking brain back online.
Why does trauma cause kids to act out, Julie?
Exactly that reason. Every human being that's listening to this has probably experienced a trauma in some way. And you know, perhaps perhaps it was a car accident. You know that at the moment that you had that car accident, you couldn't probably even remember your name, much less be able to do calculus or learn a foreign language. It's because the systems in your brain that help you survive give you this fight, flight, or freeze response to the trauma, and that takes your ability to think offline.
Aji Bola, you see the impact of trauma all the time in the work that you do. Give us a sense of how kids tend to act out and what do they do when they display the impact of that trauma for folks like you who work with them?
You know, it's interesting because they display a lot of symptoms that may appear like something else. They can be very nervous. They can be appear to be hyperactive. They can be aggressive verbally and physically. Or they could be completely shut down and withdrawn.
Or they can yell a lot, too.
Absolutely. Right? They can holler and scream and become aggressive.
How hard is it on you, day in and day out?
It can be very stressful, but I have a really great system and a good self-care plan. That's one of the things that trauma-informed care, trauma-sensitive schools promotes, is an approach that also looks at caregiver affect.
Give us a sense, if you would, of the different approaches you employ to deal with this during the course of your workday.
Well, one of the things that we like to do is to have what's called a community meeting, right, at the beginning of the day to establish, engage where students are.
So there's who's at that meeting?
It's in the classroom. So it takes place in all of the classrooms. And so upon entering the school, they leave the cafeteria, they go to their classrooms, and then it's the students and the teacher, and they take part in a conversation where they say, what are your goals for the day, and who can help you with that? Mm-hmm. You know, and helping them already determine where they are. You can see whether or not a student's going to need additional support at the beginning of the day, because maybe something happened last night and you're able to get that established in the beginning so they may get referred to the service right away. That's one of the benefits of having the community meeting.
How open are kids to revealing to you and disclosing to you if something traumatic happened the night before?
Well, one of the things that's really successful at being in an alternative environment is that they're smaller classrooms, and they're very receptive to not only myself but to the other staff, because you have to establish relationships, and we really work diligently to do that. And so the students know that I am not a disciplinarian, so they feel very comfortable and confident in the fact that it's a safe environment, and they expose a lot of information to myself.
Aji Bola, how often when you walk into a classroom at the start of the day, as you look around your charges there, can you tell almost intuitively that a boy or a girl, something's going on with that kid that you're going to need to spend more time with later on in the day?
Well, you can tell instantly because there's an established relationship. There's a rapport, so you can tell right away by the tone in the student's voice. You can tell even by the way they're dressed and their affect. And so it just kind of depends. Some days it could be a situation where it's about 30% of the classrooms that I come into that I'm going to encounter someone that's going to need that. And there are days where it can be 75%.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about this relatively new concept in public education and education in general, trauma-sensitive schooling. The Kansas City, Missouri School District is employing it as a way to deal with kids who have suffered severe trauma. Instead of punishing them, this is a different way to approach those kids to keep them in school. Aji Bola, the focus then becomes what as you work with these kids, as you deal with their emotions, keeping their tempers in check. How do you achieve that kind of difficult outcome with any one student?
Well, the goal is to teach them self-regulation competency, right? And that's about helping the students identify the emotion and how that feels in their body so they can start the process of being able to get calm and move into their thinking brain. And so you do that in a couple of different ways. One of the things that a lot of the students respond very well to is having the opportunity to do deep breathing exercises, having manipulatives such as Play-Doh, sensory bottles. Each student is different, so it's not a cookie cutter approach. You really have to establish a rapport with that student and create a safety plan. And the students work with me on that, where we talk about what are the things that are making them upset, right? We do proactive work. So prior to them having an episode, there's a safety plan that we've already created that says, you know, when I get really upset, these are the things that I like to do to help calm myself down, whether that is talking to another adult, whether that's going to a safe zone where there are calm down materials that I can utilize for up to 5 minutes so that I can regulate myself. Those are some of the types of things that
we
do.
And will students actually stand up during the course of the day and walk over and attempt to calm themselves down? Did you see that kind of activity that goes on in the classroom?
Yes. It takes work and practice. So that's what the goal is. So there are students that have got to the place where they're able to do that now because we've been working on it for, you know, the entire year. There are some students that are really struggling with it. And so it's not that they're able to go there on their own. The staff member or myself has to prompt them. This is on your safety plan. Try to use what's in your safety plan. And then once they've utilize that, then you can start that process of having a conversation with them about what was going on and how we can respond differently.
And tell us a little more about the Success Academy at Knott's, this elementary school. What is this school and who is it for?
Success Academy at Knott's is the alternative program for Kansas City Public Schools that offers academic enrichment and social and emotional development for students between kindergarten and seventh grade.
Mm-hmm. Julie Bean, again, Executive Director of the Attachment and Trauma Network. She's joining us from Atlanta this morning. Do girls respond differently than boys just in general?
In general, the girls can sometimes have behaviors that are more along the fight or fright, the freeze sort of response where they are shut down or withdrawn. And so that sometimes means that you overlook them. But it's not necessarily a gender thing. So you can also have boys that look withdrawn or very apathetic, or sometimes even teachers think that they're lazy.
Ellie, what's it been like for you to observe this? What are some of the takeaways that you've walked away with here?
You know, it didn't make it into my story, but one of the things when I visited Ajibola's classroom, she was showing me the fact that, you know, they use these kind of cards that have like different like happy faces, sad faces, you know, anger faces, because, you know, kids don't necessarily like. It takes time to realize what anger feels like, that that's the emotion that you're experiencing. And I don't think most of us as adults, like, think back remembering when we learned how to identify anger, when we learned how to identify hurt. And I think that it takes reminding for those of us that are, you know, kind of past that point when our brains are developed and, you know, we're adults now. I think it takes reminding that we're dealing with kids. Their brains aren't developed yet. They have different needs and it looks different to each of them. And it looks, you know, we don't remember developing that and we need to give them time to develop it.
Hmm. Julie, the key here, just to underscore this idea, is to keep these kids in school. And that's so important. Why?
Well, because you definitely cannot learn when you're outside of school. Mm-hmm. And it sets up a precedence for some of them of wanting to escape the school. If the school feels punitive to them and then triggers them even further in their trauma, then getting suspended or getting outside the school obviously is something that they seek. And we know that some of these children, not all of them, some of them are living in safer situations now, but some of them go home to that suspended place that is just not safe. So they are more at risk for things like addictions and drug-related type things and getting in trouble with the law. And, you know, and obviously what we see when it is trauma-sensitive is that all of those steps tend to go down as well.
Ajibola, how do you go about identifying kids who need to be targeted with special training for a school like yours? How do you do that?
Well, that's a great question. The students that come to Success Academy at Knott's are often referred from the discipline office. So that's how they are identified. That's not something that I personally assess. It's actually they've referred to the program.
Okay. Julie, how widespread now is the use of trauma-sensitive schooling across the country? Are we seeing more and more districts pick it up?
We definitely are. There's never enough, in my opinion. Our true hope at the Attachment and Trauma Network is that all schools will pick up a trauma-sensitive focus in the way that they handle children's behaviors. But I just came last week from a conference that was entirely devoted to trauma-informed schools, where I met with educators from all across the country who are implementing this at various levels. And I've got to tell you, it's really exciting to see that it helps the children that are identified of trauma, but it also doesn't hurt the children who we don't know what their backgrounds are, because we're teaching them good regulation and good communication and connection and relationship skills.
So no question, the numbers are increasing.
Yes.
And I can assume these districts aren't just in the big cities, right?
Yes. In fact, we have clients in Iowa and rural upstate New York and places along those lines, as well as folks on, you know, in the California cities and up in the Northeast.
Okay. Interesting conversation. I want to thank our very good panel here. Ajibola Adepaju, she's a behavior therapist at the Success Academy at Knott's. That's an elementary school. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Ellie Moxley is an education reporter here at KCUR. Ellie, always good to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
Julie Beam is an executive director for the Attachment and Trauma Network. She joined us from Atlanta. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the long and storied history of Operation Breakthrough, the largest daycare center here in Missouri. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we asked listeners and community leaders why Kansas City can't seem to solve its violent crime problem. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate and on the NPR One app. Well, with more than 400 kids walking through its doors each day, Operation Breakthrough ranks as one of the largest daycare operations in the entire country. But starting the organization 46 years ago and sustaining it for all these years while serving some of the poorest kids in Kansas City has been anything but easy. In fact, getting Operation Breakthrough off the ground meant taking on a Catholic bishop, a diocese, politicians, landlords, even the IRS. A new book has just been published that celebrates the great accomplishments of sisters Berta and Carita and their determination to care for many of the least among us at the center over at 31st and Troost. That book is Angels with Angles, The Rogue Nuns Behind Operation Breakthrough. The author is Loring Leifer. Joining us on to talk about this organization is Sister Berta Saylor herself. And Sister Berta, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Sister Carita is also here. Sister, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
You made it. So good to have you here. And she's joined by Mary Esselman. She's president and CEO of Operation Breakthrough. Mary, good to have you too.
Great. Thanks.
Well, the subtitle of this book labels you as a rogue nun, Berta. A rogue nun. Is that a compliment or how do you take it?
Depends who says it.
Well, the book is saying it. How do you feel about that?
I feel it's good.
Do you? Yeah.
Yeah, because we did a lot of things that were kind of frowned upon by regular people like bishops and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. But it was stuff that needed to be done.
And we're talking about starting a daycare center. Why did you have to go rogue to start a child care center?
Well, first of all, we didn't have the money to get the place up to par to start with. It was safe.
Yeah.
So we had to go that route. And then secondly, there were just so many regulations, and some of them we had to ignore because you couldn't do them.
You had to wiggle around the IRS. And at one point, you know, Sister Carita, you guys ran a gas station.
Like, yes.
To keep this thing going, a gas station. Did you go out there and pump gas yourself?
Oh, definitely.
We all did.
You cleaned off windshields and all that stuff?
Sure did.
Yeah, yeah. The kids did,
Our seventh and eighth graders pumped gas.
Yeah.
It was good for them.
Carita, what kind of ride has this been for you? 46 years. What do you make of it all?
Just like seems like yesterday.
Does it?
Oh, yeah. It doesn't seem 46 years.
the time's gone by, hasn't it?
Very quickly.
Yeah. Mary Esselman, President and CEO of Operation Breakthrough, this new book details the determination that sisters Berta and Carita showed almost every day to keep this place running. If they needed money, they got on the phone and they called people and they asked for it. If they needed a lawyer, they got on the phone, bread, hit the phone and call a baker. In fact, the book points out that Sister Berta has 1,800 entries in her smartphone. Describe that determination from your vantage point. What have you seen over the years?
Well, you know, when I first started and Sister and I would be meeting and she would have an idea about something, the next thing I know, we'd be talking about it and her phone would pop out and she would hit a number. And a minute later, she'd be talking to the mayor. You know, so numerous people. And I loved the fact that they would take that call. You know, she had such determination. And
why would a mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, take a call from Sister Berta about a daycare center?
Well, it was a huge need. We were about to walk in a 7-day walk, and Sister realized we were going to have so many parents who wanted to participate that we needed buses. We needed some city buses. So she was on the phone as we were planning and just called the mayor to let him know we were going to need two buses. And lo and behold, we had those two buses, and they were filled.
I've always had a sense that these sisters always felt like this cause was more important than anything else in the world. This comes first. This is the priority not only for them, but for many other folks around the city.
Well, absolutely. And you can see, you know, what passion and determination. When you read the book, you realize they went years without ever even taking a paycheck themselves.
Yeah.
And the number of staff that were there to support over the years, I think it just shows that true mission comes through and everyone that ends up engaging with Operation Breakthrough.
You know, Mary, how important is this organization to the families you serve?
Absolutely critical.
In what sense?
Well, when you look at right now, we're at about 420 children. And so the fact that in our last family survey, 85% of our families are working, but about 70% are living at about 40% of the federal poverty line. And so the ability to have a safe educational place for their kids during the day is just huge. Knowing that while they're out working, that their families are, their kids are learning and they're thriving is really important.
Sister Berta, you just heard Mary say you have 420 families right now, but I bet if you had the room and the space and the money, you could take 600 or even 800. Am I right about that?
Yeah, we would.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't have the space.
Yeah.
In fact, for a while, when we first went up to 400, we were licensed for 200, so we just kept taking kids.
You were licensed for two, you took four, eh?
Well, we took about three.
And who was going to throw you in jail for that, right?
Well, nobody ever came out and counted heads, but you know, we still turn down people. It makes me feel bad because I wonder what happens to them.
I was going to say, for you, how hard is it that you can't satisfy the need? I know you a little bit. That's got to be tough.
It is tough. I think that's the hardest thing, is to have a mother tell you, you know, her situation. And we try to cross every bridge and cross every corner and get it done, but sometimes we can't.
You know, Sister Berta, you describe so many of the moms that you work with as heroes. They're heroic. There's a quick story somewhere in this book about a mom who lived with her kids at a bus stop near the Power and Light District for a week, and she never missed a day of work. And that's the kind of person I think you're talking about. I bet you've seen a lot of heroes over the years.
Yes, we have. We had a woman we have moms now that get a job and live on a bus stop, live on a corner, and go to work every day. And, you know, it's hard enough to go to work every day if you go home to a house and food and clothing. But imagine going home to a bus stop.
Yeah.
As a place you're going to, I mean, it's easy to say, it's hard to do.
That's right. Really easy to say it, hard to do. Sister Carita, what do most people not understand about the poor? What do people not get?
Oh, my.
that they're people.
Mm-hmm.
They're people, live people that have the same needs that you and I have. And yet we miss them. We oversee them. We overlook them. We don't penetrate into what is it that this really is happening?
Mm-hmm.
Why is this going on? Why does this happen to me?
Mm-hmm. And you see these folks every day, right?
Day in and day out.
Another thing I think we do is you see these mothers trying so hard, and they're working and doing, you know, working for pittance and living in a shelter and trying to make it. And people look down on them, and they're not. They're some of the bravest people mm-hmm. I've met.
You know, I want to read a little passage here from Angels with Angles, this new book about Operation Breakthrough, because this little passage describes a typical day as you, Sister Berta, race from crisis to crisis at Operation Breakthrough. In fact, the book describes you as bouncing like a pinball from one emergency to another. And the book says this: each phone call and visitor brings a new dilemma. An evicted family needs a place to sleep that night. A child care worker reports a child who has bruises on her back. A little boy needs a foster home when his mom goes to jail. A mother who lost her son to gun violence needs consoling. A parent whose car broke down needs a ride to work. A student needs a bus pass. A mom still needs help with her utility bill. That'd be enough to drive you crazy, and that's one morning in the life of Sister Berta at Operation Breakthrough.
Yeah, both Sister Creed and I do that because you can't say who's going to come in the door
mm-hmm.
and what their problem is going to be. And I think people feel that poor people try and take advantage of the system. I'm sure there are some that do, but I've met very few of them.
Mm-hmm. Sister Carita, what was the toughest thing for you guys when it came to getting Operation Breakthrough off the ground? What was the biggest hurdle you had to clear?
Oh, I don't know.
Keeping Sister Berta in line probably sometimes, right?
Could be.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think knowing that we were really up against the devil in the deep blue sea, because we really didn't have what we needed to have, but it's a good thing we didn't know enough. Because if we would have known, we would have never have done what we did.
Yeah. Did you ever imagine that what you began 46 years ago would turn into a center with 400 kids?
Oh, I never dreamt of that, no. Never in my wildest dreams. Because, well, at that time, you never thought beyond your nose, practically.
Mm-hmm.
You just lived day to day, minute to minute, hoping that the next minute would be better than the one that you just went through.
Sister Berta, there's some interesting philosophy about, you know, the way you look at the world in this book. And the book says that you say often that service trumps religion, and that aiding the poor trumps prayer and reflection. And you also say that you wish people spent more time helping and less time praying. Explain that to me.
Well, I think some people feel that being religious is spending time in church, is spending time praying, and that is true. But if that's all you do, and you don't help anyone, I think when we die, the question is going to be asked, who did you help?
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, you know, how many people did you pray with today?
Yeah.
And so you just kind of got to, and I don't know if I'm right. I'll know when I'm dead if I was right.
Mm-hmm. There's another scene in this book I want to talk to you about, Sister Berta, about you walking toward your office on any given morning. And as you pass the employees who work for you, many of them were trying to make themselves scarce out of fear that you were going to ask them just very spontaneously to walk away from their work for an urgent task that needed doing right away, like unloading a truck or serving up lunch at that time.
Right.
Do you scare your employees? Do they tend to sort of hide behind their work as you walk by sometimes? Mary Esselman's laughing here. She knows exactly what we're talking about. Is that true?
It is so true.
They run for cover?
Well, no.
Here she comes.
You know, there's one person in the building that no one can ever say no to, and that's Sister Berta. Mm-hmm. And she just has a lot of ideas and a lot of things that she needed staff for. And so...
Because stuff is coming at her all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. It's stuff that's important stuff to whoever mm-hmm. it's affecting, so people yep. don't want to say no to her. Mm-hmm. Do you notice your employees hiding from you sometimes as you're walking through the building?
Well, what's funny is the walls in the level where the offices are don't go to the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And so Sister just has to call people's name. So she can just go, Kayla, or whomever. And no one can say they didn't hear her because the walls are lower.
Yeah. You know, I just want to ask the two sisters here. The book also points out, Sister Carita, that as the years pass, you guys worry about the future of the families who come to Operation Breakthrough each day. And I'm wondering, what do you worry about?
I don't worry. I do not worry. Worry is a waste of time,
mm-hmm.
a waste of energy.
Does Sister Berta, is she the one who worries?
All the time.
All the time. Sister Berta, what do you worry about?
Everything.
They said together in unison. Do you worry a lot, Sister Berta?
I do. And some things happen and some things don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't happen, you say, oh, thank God it didn't happen. If it does happen, you say, well, now what are you going to do about it?
Tell me about the future of Operation Breakthrough. What is it?
I think I would like it to see to get bigger,
mm-hmm.
to serve more kids. To have more room for kids. I'd like to have a housing program. We have a small one now, but it's not very big. I'd like to have someone give us an apartment building that mothers could rent out and mm-hmm. have a place to live. We have some moms in apartments, but, you know, all that goes together, and it's not easy for these mothers to
yeah.
do this, and they try so hard, and people look down on them as if they're lazy, good-for-nothings, and they're not.
You know, I described you talking about the mothers as heroes, and you guys know that to so many people here in Kansas City, you too are heroes, and what you've meant to this town for so many years. I think I can speak for a lot of people. Thank you very much. You've done a lot of good stuff. Sure, appreciate it.
A lot of people help us.
Yeah.
We couldn't do it without all the people that help us.
Yeah.
So.
Sister Berta, Sister Carita, Mary Esselman from Operation Breakthrough. The new book is called Angels with Angles, The Rogue Nuns Behind Operation Breakthrough. And they'll be speaking about this book and its long history at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. 6:30 Wednesday evening. You can see Sister Berta, Mary Esselman, maybe Sister Carita will be there too. Thank you all very much for coming in today. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you
Good
for
luck.
Having us.
You bet. Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Well, from sisters Berta and Carita to Brian McTavish and Katie Geen and the girls, the only person who can make a transition like that is the one and only Brian McTavish.
Oh.
Who can talk about cool stuff to do on the weekend. How are you? Welcome back.
Those were some lovely women.
They're incredible, aren't they?
Incredible.
They are great heroines of this community. There's no question about that.
I'm not sure we can follow, but let's do our best.
Let's do our best.
We have to anyway.
We have to carry on.
The weekend beckons, Steve. It's
Boulevardia.
Ooh, together we almost did that.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, many bands and much beer will be consumed at the Stockyards in the West Bottoms. It starts at 4 o'clock Friday. It starts at 11 and goes till 11 or 12 at night on Saturday. And yes, we're listening to Katie Geehan and the girls. You want to catch their local act? I bet they'll do this tune, Humbucker.
I bet they will.
I don't know what a humbucker is.
I don't know either.
But it's blues.
You should know that, though. That's part of your job is to have these questions answered when you walk in the door.
Blues. That's a good one. That's a good one. Blues is a malleable
humbucker.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of Fuddruckers. Remember Fuddruckers?
Let's be careful.
Hey, that was right there on the street for years.
Okay.
Anyway, 7:40. The blues is not a careful instrument. 7:40, Friday night, you can catch Katie and the girls.
Wow.
But it's a variety of sprightly bands and sudsy beers. And you've got, Friday night, the headliners include George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. And then Saturday night, you can, have a party with local natives and Guster. And, just keep an eye out on anybody about our age, because they might be in trouble. It's going to be fun.
I woke up still not dead again today. Internet said I had passed away. Well, if I died, I wasn't dead to stay. I woke up still not dead again today. Well, I woke up still not dead again today. The gardener did not find me that way.
Well, thank goodness he's not dead. Anyway, that's Willie Nelson who's going to be here this weekend. And I should just point out that Bill Brownlee, who does our local listens each Wednesday, says that Willie Nelson is more vital, is better than ever.
I cannot doubt the wise words
listen
of Bill
to him.
Brownlee.
Sounds great.
Listen to him. Let's listen to him. Yeah. Willie Nelson puts on a reliably wonderful country music show every single time. And it's country time at 6:30 Saturday at Starlight Theater. Not dead. Are you kidding? He's going to liven things up along with opening bands Dwight Yoakam and Robert Earl Keane. He's 84.
84.
And he might talk about pot. He might. I bet he will.
He's got some history there.
He's got a song, Roll Me Up and Smoke Me When I Die.
There you go. Be sure to see Brian's Six Things to Do with Dad in Kansas City this week. And that's right, it's Father's Day.
Sunday.
I hope a couple of young boys remember it's Father's Day.
I hope more than a couple
It's always a gamble when you wake up on Sunday morning. You wonder if they're there or not.
Oh, no. Something tells me your sons are totally there for you on Father's Day. Even if they're not.
Okay, we hope you're right.
They're there in their heads, Steve. Trust
me. Brian's Six Things to Do with Dad in Kansas City this weekend. Yeah. KCUR.org to see Brian's list.
Mummification equals immortality. Your brain's pulled out your nose by an embalmer priest. Canopic jars preserve the liver and the rest. Your heart's left in for the feather of truth's test. Bunch of linen bandages, some natron salt and ice.
We're talking mummies?
Okay, it's Father's Day weekend. What better time for mummies?
Yeah, I'm confused.
And the whole...
There's a connection, apparently.
Well, it's a coinkadink.
Okay.
It's Mummies of the World. It's the world's largest traveling exhibit of mummies and related bandage-strewn artifacts ever assembled. And it's supposed to be done tastefully, if you can imagine that. So our promoters are saying, bring the kids! Starting Saturday and Sunday to Union Station, basically what you have a lot of mummies, right?
Yeah.
And some of these are intentionally mummified, like, the Egyptian kind. And then you have, like, the mummified family from Hungary, believed to have died from tuberculosis. I don't know how it happened, but they'll teach you if you show up this weekend to Union Station and learn all about the mummies.
We'll leave it that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Chance to play
and sing it.
I figure it's about the happiest sound going down today.
That's Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Yeah, no longer with us.
Yes.
But
The group's not, but some of the members are.
Yes, I do believe that Peter and Paul are breathing.
Yes.
Mary Travers went away some years
ago.
Sadly. Yeah, because she was really, hey, let's face it, she was the heart of that situation, right? So, Peter, Paul, and Mary as a thing in our heads and in our ears and in our eyes. It's Peter, Paul, and Mary alive. Are you ready for that?
Yes, I am.
It happens. This tribute to bygone folk music icons, PP and M, at 7:30 Saturday night, absolutely free at the Legacy Park Amphitheater in Lee's Summit.
That'd be fun.
Oh, are you kidding me? I mean, 500 miles and leaving on a jet plane, and if you had a hammer, what would you do with it? Find out Saturday in Lee's Summit. Do it.
And finally today.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my papa, to me he was so
Yes, back to Father's Day.
Back to Father's
Briefly, and those sons will come through for you. They are.
I mean, I'm holding my breath.
Is it a card thing now? They're older. Do they get you something?
I'm hoping for a phone call from Nick in Chicago.
I see.
Michael is with us, and he has no choice. He better come through.
I might drive
He's
to St.
Right
Louis.
Under my nose.
I might. This father talking to you right now might get in his car
there
on Sunday morning and meet his son in St. Louis at a comic book convention.
Really?
Because after
all,
it is Father's Day.
It is Father's Day.
It is Father's Day. And if you go to the zoo on Father's Day, dads get in free, and guess what else they get?
What?
A hot dog.
No.
Yes.
A reason to go. A reason to live.
Yes. Every dad should have his hot dog. He can get it from 8 to 5 on Sunday at the Kansas City Zoo. And I love this Eddie Fisher song. Corny but true.
Okay. That's
love
Brian
dad.
McTavish
love
with
dad.
Your weekend to-do list, your Father's Day edition.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. You can do that at kcur.org/uptodate. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. And you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. I miss him so.